Hello there, everyone. It's Radio Free Nintendo, a podcast about video games and video game things.
For grown-ups.
For grown-ups. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today is Jonathan Lindemann.
Always a pleasure, Johnny.
Too many damn Jonathans on this show. Filling out our trio for this segment is Greg Leahy.
Hello there.
Who I like to think of as an honorary Jonathan.
Really?
I don't know what that means. So, yes, as I kind of alluded to, James is not here right now because his power is out. He got caught in a nasty thunderstorm, and we have our fingers crossed that he's going to get reconnected and we'll be able to show up for Retroactive later in the show. But if not, it's not the end of the world because Neil Ronahan is actually planning to join us a little bit later to talk about Mother 3, and he beat the game. So he's our expert witness for that segment. So anyway, we'll talk about Mother 3 a little bit later. We're going to start with new business, and John is up first.
My new business is actually kind of going back a ways. My wife came to me the other day and said that, my wife, the non-gamer, of course, that she would like to play video games. She would like to actually play the Wii. No euphemism involved.
Wow.
And this was kind of unexpected, so I kind of really didn't know what we were going to play. And I suggested Mario Kart Wii. And this is interesting. I think I have kind of a feature sort of brewing on this, I think. But but yeah, it's always interesting because she really, I mean, she has no gaming skills with a Z at all. So it's funny watching her play Nintendo games that everybody else would think are very easy to pick up and play. Mm-hmm. And with Mario Kart Wii, I figured that I would start her off with the Wii wheel for the fact that I think that actually controlling the game with the nunchuck and the Wii remote, for somebody who doesn't really know how to play the game at all, is actually more confusing because it's more abstract. It's a more abstract way to control the game. I mean, if you hand somebody the Wii wheel and say, okay, you treat it like a steering wheel, well, it's a lot easier.
No, I totally get that. I mean, I think playing with the Wii wheel is less accurate. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's actually a layer that I have to get through to play the game.
Yeah.
But totally agree that it's more accessible. It's simpler. There's less to explain.
Yeah, it's much more intuitive. But the catch is, try explaining to somebody who doesn't know how to do it how to do the boosting through corners, or actually how to even power slide through corners. Because I was explaining it like, okay, when you come into a corner, turn to the right and jump with B, that thing on the back. Jump, and then hold it. Keep holding it. And she's just like, I mean, meanwhile, she's like running into walls and, you know, she can't even really figure out what's going on.
You know, there's like an easy mode you can turn on where it'll automatically power slide.
Well, that's the automatic, right?
Yeah.
See, the thing is, though, this was probably a bad choice on my part, is we started off playing online, which was probably a bad idea because it's really hard to learn that way, because not only do you have, you know, good players, I mean, you're playing good players, and you have these jerks that always choose Rainbow Road, which is just such a pain in the ass, because you know they like to screw people with it.
So, not the first track you want to play.
Yeah, we're like, you know, we're trying to, like, we're like, Shy Guy Beach, Rainbow Road, we're like, fuck!
Oh, and it comes up twice in a row.
Oh, yeah. Well, what you'll see is...
You voted for it again?
Well, the thing is, you'll see teams of people. You'll see, like, four people. Like, we played this one game with four people that were obviously playing, you know, at the same place. I mean, they came up on the map in the same place. So they were playing, like, as a team, and they all chose Rainbow Road, all four of them. I was like, you bastards.
Oh, man.
Like, just, what a dick move.
Block vote.
So, of course, you know, we have Rainbow Road.
That's their griefing clan.
It's terrible.
Just roam the internet and, like, and destroy people in Mario Kart.
But we're trying to play Rainbow Road, and the best advice I can give is just go slow. That's all I can say.
Go slow.
I suck at it, too. I'm horrible at Rainbow Road.
Controversial advice in a racing game.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you try to go fast and you don't know what you're doing, I mean, you're constantly...
It's actually the
worst, because you're constantly falling off.
Yeah, I mean, you should not have taken her online.
No, it was a bad idea. But
I think Mario Kart is probably a decent choice to kind of get someone into gaming.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, yeah, stick with the wheel. Make sure she's using the automatic mode so she doesn't have to worry. You can still get boost off of power slides, but not as much.
Yeah.
And and it's not a huge step up to, you know, once you get used to that. What I mean, the thing is, in a driving game like that, the very first thing you have to learn is just the feel of the steering, right? I mean, the acceleration is basically automatic, but you have to get a feel for, you know, how to oversteer, how to understeer, how to stay on a decent racing line.
Yeah.
And then she's also dealing with all these items and bumping into other characters.
Well, yeah. I mean, the items online were huge because, I mean, you have people, you know, screwing you over left, right, and center.
Sure. And if you play the computer, that's not going to happen as much.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you're completely right with, like, learning when not to oversteer and understeer and all that, because I find with the Wii Wheel, you know, when you first get it in your hands, at least somebody who hasn't played the game very much, they're going all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
When you really don't have to move the Wii Wheel much at all. I mean, you can hold it pretty much still. In fact, you should.
Yeah, and that's good training as well, because it takes practice to learn to hold a motion controller still.
Mm-hmm.
Because your instinct is to just kind of wave it all over the place. Mm-hmm. Some people wave their controllers all over the place even if there's no motion control.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's actually something you have to be more careful about when you're playing a Wii game is that, you know, you need to watch where you're holding this thing.
Well, it was really funny because she was having problems doing much of anything with the Wii Wheel. And so I said, okay, hold on a second. I'll switch you over, you know, maybe hoping that the nunchuck and Wii remote would suit her better. And so I hand her the nunchuck and the Wii remote, and it was so funny because she looks at them. It was like she was looking at, I don't know. She had this look on her face like, what in the hell did you just put in my hands? And I mean, it's not like she hasn't played Wii before, right? But she's played stuff like, you know, like Wario, like Smooth Moves and stuff like that, where it's just very, you know, simple sort of stuff. And it was just classic. She's just like, how in the hell do I translate this into that on the screen?
So you were going for a bridge title.
I was going for a bridge title, and the thing is, because I ran into this when we were playing New Super Mario Bros. Wii, that is not a bridge title, because if you don't, it's a hard game, and if you don't know what you're doing, it's a pain in the ass, especially with that kind of gameplay where there are certain areas where if you really want to succeed, you're going to have to grind them a little bit and do them over and over again to kind of perfect what you're doing, right? Because I was like, you know, me, I'm trying to, like, you know, get every single coin in the whole level, right? And I'm just like, and, you know, we would die, and oh, let's do that over again and over again and over again. And she's like, okay, can we just move on and do something else?
Yeah, yeah.
That's, you know,
yeah,
that's...
you should probably gonna have to adapt your play style to, you know, having someone else there who's, you know, to be more like a tutor and less playing like you normally would by yourself.
Yeah.
Do you have Zach and Wiki?
Yeah, I do.
That is a very good wife/girlfriend/boyfriend game.
Hmm.
Because basically she can play along without actually even holding a controller.
Yeah.
But even then you can give her a controller and she can point at things.
Yeah.
And I mean, the same kind of goes with, like, Galaxy 2.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that mode would be interesting to her.
Well, she likes action games. I mean, she likes being in on the action. Like, I mean, one of her favorite games is Tekken, because, you know, she could just sit there and button mash. But there's a big difference between actually kind of knowing what you're doing in Tekken and just sitting there button mashing.
You might try Smash Brothers, because you can play it without the nunchuck.
Mm-hmm.
If she's used to Tekken, that's a point of entry, I think, for Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
There's obviously a little more going on the screen. I mean, that's always the first challenge with Smash Brothers, is just like visually being able to visually identify what the hell's going on.
Yeah, especially when it zooms out. I mean, that usually loses people when it zooms out and they're like, where the hell am I?
So stick to a small stage.
Yeah.
Flat zone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, we'll see. I think it's this is going to be kind of an ongoing experiment. She's going to be my pet project.
The other thing, and this might seem a little bit weird, but I've always heard tons of stories about this kind of thing, is you might...
Ghouls and ghosts.
Yeah, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was my first
Secret Castle.
No, I was actually gonna say some kind of like Japanese RPG.
Yeah.
I don't know if she has any experience watching you play something like that, but Dragon Quest IX actually, I mean, it was hugely popular with women in Japan, and the entire Dragon Quest series is. And I know my entire life I've known friends and I've heard stories of guys would be playing these Japanese RPGs and their sister or their girlfriend would basically just sit there and watch and would get interested in the story. And it's more slow paced, so it's a little bit easier to follow what's going on. And then, you know, over time, they get totally invested in it and they play it themselves and get just as good at it. I mean, you know, and that's a game that you can play. I mean, even though there's a lot of numbers and stuff, it's easy to play. Like, it's maybe not the easiest thing to understand. You have to take some time to learn how the game works, but it's not imposing.
Yeah, no, she did see me playing Final Fantasy 13, and there wasn't too much interest there.
It wasn't like, it's like playing a movie.
No, it wasn't that. It wasn't a PlayStation commercial.
I know you've been playing a little bit of Dragon Quest IX. Did you have anything you wanted to say about it?
Not too much more. You know, I was actually meeting, I know you're going to talk about the GameStop event you went to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, the GameStop, I think the only GameStop around here in Atlanta that was doing it was really, really far away. I didn't have a chance to...
I had to drive about 20, 25 minutes myself,
yep.
Which is stupid because there's a GameStop around the corner, and they didn't have it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a GameStop in the mall right across the street from my apartment.
Yeah.
But the only one was, same thing, about 20 minutes away.
Well, I think what happened is that Nintendo, you know, there was this special item that they were giving out through tag mode, and the way that they did that is I think they basically shipped out Nintendo DS systems to these stores that had that in the account.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically gave the stores instructions on how to set it up so that when people showed up, it would connect.
Yeah.
And because of that, then maybe they didn't have enough or they didn't want to go through the process of sending it to every single store.
Yeah.
But, and there were some promotional materials there as well. There were posters and stickers and things. So there was some overhead involved. I can understand why they only did it at certain stores, but I felt like the selection was really limited based on the number of stores in my area, and
yeah,
there was one that had the event going on.
So I'm waiting to see, I'm waiting to get your take on whether or not it was worth your while.
Okay, well, let's come back to it after Greg.
Yep, well, since it's just the three of us, I'm going to mention one little thing. I did, obviously, last week I played Donkey Kong Country Returns at the event, and I played it. I enjoyed it. I liked the feel of it. I mean, obviously, a little skeptical about some of the gesture-based stuff if you're going to be dealing with some really challenging platform things later on in the game. Oh, yeah, quite tricky, the demo. Certainly decidedly more tricky than Kirby.
Yeah, yes.
But one thing that really sort of intrigued me is when I played it was the boss. And I actually thought the boss was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't all that intricate or it wasn't all that amazing, but you see, for a demo boss, you're not expecting it to be anything that advanced. And I just thought, oh, it was pretty good.
The funny thing is that boss in the Donkey Kong Returns, Donkey Kong Country Returns demo, it actually reminded me of some of the bosses in Wario Land Shake It.
Yeah, I could see that. So I thought, you know, this was pretty good. And then I cast my mind back to the original DKC. And I thought, I hadn't played in quite a while, and I thought to myself, weren't all the bosses in that awful? And so I decided to go back
they
and
were
see
pretty terrible.
If I remembered this correctly. So I've still got my Super NES working. Plugged in the cartridge, which had a completed save on it. Not, alas, the original 101% save. It wiped itself at some point and I lost that.
Tragedy.
Yeah, I'm not as broken up about that as I was the Yoshi's Island one. That took a lot more work. But it was a completed save, so I could go around and I could do the bosses and stuff, and yeah, they were awful. They were really bad. They're just like giant enemies and you just bop them and they don't really do very much.
They basically just kind of like roll around or fly around, and there's a barrel that comes out of somewhere and all you have to do is pick up the barrel and throw it at the boss.
And sometimes it's not even that, you know, because it's like, oh, there's a tire in the middle, just jump up and hit the vulture's head when it pops out of the side, and it doesn't even get a chance to do anything. I mean, they are so simple, it's kind of crazy. They're not even visually that, like, anything all that interesting, you know, for a game that was very visually leveraged.
Well, no, they look kind of terrible, because I think aren't they mostly based on the same monster models, but just kind of blown up?
They're not quite, like, literally the same sprite blown up. It's not quite that bad, but they don't look anything great. But I think DKC2 is a bit better about it, but I haven't played that in a while. But, you know, that is what it does strike me with Donkey Kong Country Returns, that there is actually quite a lot of room for improvement in terms of what they can do.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was, I think most people would say that the first Donkey Kong Country especially was pretty formulaic, you know, though solid. And certainly what I played the second one on Virtual Console, and I thought that was better.
It is, and I think the third one's actually my favorite.
See, now I've not played that one, and I was wondering if that's worth a purchase at some point.
I guess it depends on how much you like the other two, but I think it's a further refinement. I think the overworld stuff in the third one is really interesting. It's quite a lot deeper. And
yeah, it's pretty perfunctory in the first one, that's for sure.
Yeah, there are large sections of the overworld in the third game where you can just roam around and like find secret caves and things. So it's not just it's not like a Super Mario World map. It's
right.
It's like you walk around.
It is more like an overworld rather right. than a map with a level map, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think the level designs are more interesting in the third one for me. I was never a huge fan of the second one. The second one was, like, too hard.
It's quite tricky, yeah. So, I mean, it's amazing that how fast they churn those out. I mean, literally 94, 95, 96. I mean, I know you weren't talking about, you know, the kinds of development challenges that you'd have with the games of today. But that's still a really good clip to get those kinds of games out in those
no
days.
No doubt. Yeah. I mean, I think when Nintendo saw the hit that they had with the first one, they were like,
yeah, it's production line this shit, basically. Yeah.
So, actually, since you brought up DKC Returns, I wanted to mention a few things that I heard at E3 that I don't think I've sort of at one point promised to bring them up on the show and then never did. So maybe I can make up for that now.
Huh.
So when we were playing the demo at one point, I played it a couple times. There was one time I played it co-op, which was fairly difficult, I thought, just because there was more going on with the screen and we weren't really clear on the interactions that were possible between the two characters. So there was a lot of trial and error with that. But at one point I was sort of standing next to a couple of other people and, you know, we were taking turns playing the demo, and the producer at Retro Studios, Brian Walker, was standing next to the demo, and I've interviewed Brian in the past for Metroid Prime games, and I sort of know him from that, and so I went over and talked to him, and I was, you know, just really curious because we hadn't heard any kind of official statement from Retro. They weren't doing very many interviews at E3. We didn't get to interview them, but they gave very, very few interviews.
Yeah, they were always like that.
Yeah, I was disappointed that we didn't get an interview with them, but I was like, oh, here's Brian. I'll just talk to him now and ask him everything that I would have if we had gotten an interview. And so the first thing he asked me, and this is why I love Brian, and I love developers who do this, he's standing there watching people play it, being very analytical, very critical about it. And I walk over and I say, hey, you know, can I ask you some things? And the first thing he says is, do you have any criticisms that I could bring back to the team? Like that, he's there to make the game better. Like he's using this opportunity. And it makes sense with Nintendo. I mean, you know that demo's not going to be played by that many people between E3 and the game's release.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do that. They don't digitally distribute demos. They don't have that many press events. They don't have any public gameplay events, really. So very few opportunities for him to get that kind of feedback from the outside world. And so the first thing he says is, do you have any criticisms? And I said, well, you know, I don't feel confident in saying anything right now, but I'll follow up with you. And I did email him some thoughts from the staff. I sort of collected some ideas, mainly about the controls, that we had some suggestions. But then I asked him a few things, and I can sort of paraphrase here some of his comments. I asked him how he felt about going from making these huge, expansive 3D games with the Metroid Prime series into doing a 2D platformer. And he said it was really interesting because he said the way that the game sort of came into being is that they finished Prime 3 and they spent 2 or 3 months sort of prototyping some ideas. I mean, Retro is a small studio. They only have like 40-ish full-time employees. They bring in contractors for certain parts of games during certain phases of development, but they only have enough people to make one game at a time. So they finished Corruption, and then basically they started working on a few different ideas. They weren't exactly sure where they wanted to go with it. And then Nintendo came in and basically said, hey, we are kind of interested in doing a new Donkey Kong Country. How would you guys feel about that? And basically, they just immediately said, yes, we want to do that. So the idea for Retro to do this came from Nintendo. It was sort of handed down to them. And he said that as they've been working on it, he's never worked on a game before. And I think Brian came from Iguana before Retro, so maybe the Turok stuff and, you know, Arrow the Acrobat. I'm not sure exactly which games he worked on before Metroid Prime series. But he said that he's never seen a development team so excited to play the game that they're making. And when they bring in focus testers and when they show it to people, he's really excited at how much fun people have and how, I guess, and it makes sense if you think about the disparity between Donkey Kong Country and Metroid Prime, because Metroid Prime is a really complex game.
Yeah.
And when people play it, they're really focused, they're quiet, they're thinking, they're paying attention, they're really concentrating on it. And it's a game that requires your full attention, whereas Donkey Kong Country is clearly more of a sit down and have fun with it type of game. And he said that he was really enjoying seeing that expression on people's faces when they play it.
I'm sure it was a breath of fresh air for them to design that type of game after Metroid Prime, after three Prime games.
Sure. I can imagine that it must be. He said they've been making it since like early 2008.
Yeah, basically after the turmoil when the key guys left, it was not long after that.
Right, yeah. If I had to guess, I'd say maybe they were working on some kind of follow-up to, you know, maybe something a little more like Metroid Prime. And then when those guys left, they said, maybe we should scrap that idea and do something different.
Yeah.
He didn't say that. That's just my guess.
Well, the thing is, I mean, one of those guys was their tech director. So he would have been the driving force behind any kind of 3D engine that they would have been working on. So, I mean, even though they still had the engine there, obviously they couldn't just take that engine and, you know, sit on it for 2 years and just crank out another game with that engine. They probably would have had to tweak it and stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a significant event in the development of whatever ideas they were looking into at the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I asked them if they had consulted with EAD Tokyo. You know, I asked them how much they were sort of basing this on Jungle Beat and whether they had any sort of consulting from EAD Tokyo, and he said that he had never talked to any of those guys before. They're not involved whatsoever. I mean, you know, he said they've been very busy with Galaxy 2, obviously, and they have no involvement in DKC Returns whatsoever. And he said that some people on the Retro team are fans of Jungle Beat, but they didn't design Returns as any kind of follow-up. They didn't, like, tell everybody to go home and play Jungle Beat to get ideas or to see what they did. It wasn't anything like that. It was basically developed as a totally independent game, and he said that he personally wasn't even all that familiar with Jungle Beat, and he's the producer of DKC Returns. So I was surprised because they actually look quite similar. I'm sure you would agree, Greg. I mean, not, I say similar, but, you know, they both have Donkey Kong. He slaps his hands on the ground. There are a lot of elements that look quite similar, even though they feel a lot different when you play them, of course.
They certainly do feel different. I mean, I do like the whole when you do the roll with the flick of the remote and then jump out of it, just how massive that jump is.
Yeah.
Now, like, it's huge. It could be really quite useful for like secret areas and stuff, you know, making jumps that you couldn't otherwise make without doing some advanced maneuvers and stuff. And I mean, you know, there's going to be loads of stuff to collect, which we'll see how well that goes down. I mean, if it requires, you know, sort of like skill and, you know, unique kind of exploitation of the ability set that you've got there, then I'm fine with that. Whereas if it's kind of just looking for all sorts of obscure little bits,
Baphomet,
I'm not so enthused about that. That's the terrible end point, if you like, of what DKC began.
In terms of there being lots of hidden stuff, that I have absolute faith in Retro Studios. I mean, they're, you know, the things they did with the Metroid Prime map designs and the way they scattered collectibles all over the place and made them, every single one of them is unique, is like a puzzle to get to. And when you're working with a 2D space, the kinds of puzzles, the kind of exploration that you can do is different. But I have no doubt that they will be doing a great job with that. I don't think we're in for any kind of Donkey Kong 64 thing where there's just thousands of little tic-tacs.
I also wonder whether if in any kind of situations they could find some cool uses, perhaps, you know, context-sensitive for the pointer, because this is one of the rare side-scrollers on Wii that's actually using, you know, Wii Remote and Nunchuck, so you could be pointing at the screen.
It's true.
And doing something, you know, maybe some puzzles, you know, some switching or something, you know, just so that to distinguish it a bit more from Kirby and Wario and New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I mean, I've always wanted the Yoshi game using the pointer, which would be like all the time.
Yeah.
But still, even just context sensitive would be cool.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a great point. It was a little surprising to see that the demo units for DKC Returns have a nunchuck attached, because it seems like the game could be played on just the remote sideways. And actually, one of the recommendations that I emailed him later after talking to the staff who had played it is, you know, since you've got the remote and the nunchuck, you've got a fair number of buttons to work with, and some of them had repeated functions. And so rather than do that, make it possible to do, for instance, the roll move with a button instead of a gesture,
yeah,
maybe as an option. Just because we were finding that the roll didn't always happen when we wanted it to or at the exact moment.
I mean, there's obviously kind of a big thing with a number of Wii games that are basically traditionally controlled, but they have one action or two that are gesture activated.
Yeah.
And, you know, where I find I'm all right with those is where it's not something that's necessarily, like, really timing sensitive. So, for instance, Galaxy.
Right. There's always kind of a margin for error in Galaxy. And in that Donkey Kong demo, there is no margin for error.
Yeah, there's some tricky stuff in that with the rickety minecart bit and all that. I mean, it was pretty challenging stuff for a demo. But, I mean, with Galaxy, for instance, the spin move is kind of like a fudge move.
Yep.
Like, it's to correct a jump that you did wrong, or it's to stun an enemy that you haven't got the balls to jump on. You know, it's kind of like a get-out-of-jail kind of thing. Although, obviously, in some cases, especially actually in 2, they use it a bit more strictly,
yep,
like with the flip-swap Galaxy and one of the later Galaxies as well. But in general, it's not something that you should really expect to sort of have to use precisely all the time. Or like what they do in New Super Mario Bros. Which is kind of like a riff off it, where it extends your jump and this sort of thing. I'm all right with that, but that role in DKC seems a little bit fundamental to have,
yeah,
it exclusively mapped to a gesture.
Right, that's basically what I said when I gave him the feedback. But anyway, maybe we should move on, Greg, and talk about the other game that you've been playing.
Well, I've been playing,
yes.
Yeah, so this is something I've been chipping away at for quite... I've had it for quite a while, and I've been chipping away at it gradually. We've got to get towards the end now, so it's a decent time to start talking about it. Rabbids Go Home. So this is last year's Rabbids game.
Oh, yeah, that's that Rayman thing, right?
I was actually surprised you played this, Greg. This was one where I'm just like, what?
Well, Rabbids is my first Rabbids game.
Yeah,
it's the one that broke the streak of minigame. You know, ever since the Wii came out, they basically did an annual minigame collection Rabbids title.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, for whatever reason, coming out of Ubisoft Montpellier, which is, I think, where Michel Ancel works out of, although I don't think he was particularly involved in this game.
No, I don't think he's been all that involved with any of the Rabbids games, really.
Exactly. But this one is, you know, sort of just a single-player game. It does have, like, your typical Wii sort of subsidiary co-op mode where the other player can kind of help along a little bit. It's basically a proper single-player game. And, yeah, I mean, you know, as you might expect at this point, it was pretty cheap for a tenner. But the thing is, if it was just about cheap, I could have had it ages ago, because this, in terms of price online at your usual online retailers, it tanked very rapidly. I must have sold below expectations, at least at those specific retailers over here, because it certainly became very affordable very quickly. But it, you know, it had good reviews. Pedro reviewed it for us. He gave it a 9. But there were plenty of other places as well. I know IGN, I think one of the last reviews that Casa Messina would have done at IGN, I think, for a Wii game,
mm-hmm,
was an 8.5. You know, there's a lot of good reviews. So yeah, for a good price, and I was kind of intrigued to see what it was like. And, I mean, it's mostly compared to things like the Katamari games, which I haven't played, and also The Blob, which itself is compared to the Katamari games. And it's a similar kind of experience to The Blob, if you've played that. Yeah, there's quite a lot of differences. It's more similar to Katamari in the sense that it's just about amassing stuff. The Rabbids have decided that they come from the moon and are going to pile a bunch of crap up to it to go home. Mm-hmm. So there's all this crap just littered around the levels, and you drive into it with a shopping cart to collect it, and that's sort of it.
Well, does the gameplay change depending on the amount of stuff that's in the shopping cart?
No, see, the gameplay...
See, that's too bad. I mean, that's the trick to Katamari, is that as you amass more and more stuff, the game is constantly changing dynamically around you because of that.
And it's a bit like, sort of, that's a bit like what happens in Orbient or Orbital, in the sense that,
exactly,
you know, your planetary body becomes, you know, very different to, you know, how you control it. It feels very radically different as it gets
right.
bigger. So no, it's not like that. The handling of the shopping cart stays the same. And I mean, I like the handling of the shopping cart. It controls very well. It feels just about right. But there are ways in which the gameplay kind of changes somewhat. I mean, it's more dynamic than something like the Blob, which doesn't really change very much across its entirety.
No, it doesn't.
With this, there are some change-ups. Like, so you've got your basic kind of level will be pretty linear. You're going from, you know, a bunch of rooms to a bunch of rooms, collecting stuff. Like, some of it will just be lying there. Others of it will have to be dislodged somehow, either by using this sort of gesture-based attack to, like, scare clothes off people and, you know, like, just empty out bins and all this sort of stuff. Or as later in the game, this is one way it develops, you get like a power slide move, which means that you kind of charge up a little blue spark on your wheels, then dash into something. It sort of dislodges and collects the rubbish all in one move, which makes it very much more possible to collect things efficiently, quickly, which comes in with certain like time challenges. Like another different kind of level that you get in the latter parts of the game is like a chase sequence. Like the Rabbids just see a cow on a truck and say, right, we've got to have this. So then you're kind of chasing this cow. And so you can't really just like stop and wait to collect all this stuff that's strewn around, otherwise the truck gets away. So you've got to be able to collect it at speed, and that's where the use of the power slide comes in. And there's a few other sort of change-ups. There's a bit where you sort of on this bizarre slalom in a giant rubber tire, where you kind of have to bounce off all these boards to collect things properly. And there's one where the Rabbids steal a jet engine, which handles completely differently from everything else in the game. So there's some variety. But the problem that I found with it is that it kind of runs out about half to two-thirds of the way through. And what you start getting then is some of these themes repeated quite a lot. Certainly the level themes get repeated. I mean, there's a few kind of things, like there's a mall, there's an airport.
So it's a Tony Hawk game.
Yeah, well, it is a little bit. I mean, because a lot of what
Area
you do...
Area 51.
You know, it's not really like a platformer, because you kind of, you know, it's a bit like a racing game in a way, but you are using ramps and stuff, especially if you try to collect like the most stuff possible to get like a better score at the end of the level. You will be using ramps to like make big leaps into the air to get like some of the harder to reach items and stuff. So it's, you know, there's probably something in common with a skateboarding game in that way. But you know, you've got these set of locations which are all like really dreary, really Spartan, and it's really what they go for with the art style is pretty effective, I think. They're going for this sort of minimalist style, and the whole stick is like it's this consumerist sort of humorless dystopia where everyone's these like rake thin people that are all really scared, and the Rabbids are just gonna, you know, terrify them and have fun in this place. But and it seems like exactly the kind of thing you do on Wii, you know. It's simple, but it works within the context of the game. You know, it makes lots of sense, and it actually looks pretty good without being processor intensive. Mm-hmm. The curious thing about it is that it doesn't run that well. There's actually quite regular screen tearing problems, which is not something I've encountered in just about any Wii game before.
You used to see it a lot on PS2.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, Shadow of the Colossus has some pretty bad screen tearing.
It's nothing that's like really severely detrimental to the experience, but it is a little bit distracting sometimes and just odd, given that, you know, it does look appropriate, but it also looks, you know, pretty simple. So you're kind of wondering sometimes what the problem is. But, you know, in terms of these level themes that repeat, like I said, after a while, it feels like you've kind of seen what the game's got to offer in terms of wrinkles and variations on the theme, which are, you know, not massive, but they're welcome and they help keep it fresh for quite a while. But then it kind of bogs down and feels a bit stretched out towards the end. But it's still fun. I mean, I've enjoyed this. It's a pretty quality title, I think. I mean, it's easy for me to say that I haven't paid a tenner for it, I suppose. But
so, are you ready for another dose of it this fall with the Rabbids Travel Through Time or whatever?
Yeah,
it's
that's
called?
That's back to the minigame stuff, though, isn't it?
Is it? No, I think it's a.
No, it is. I mean, I think supposedly they've said that it's going to be a bit more substantive than the previous Rabbids minigame collections, but it is go back. So, yeah, I guess this, you know, obviously didn't do what they wanted it to, because they've gone back to the old formula.
It shows what I know about that game. Of course, I was at the Ubisoft press conference, and...
yeah, I'm sure you're just like, Rabbids?
No, I mean, it's just the trailer they showed was just... It was like the CG trailer of Rabbids running around through a time machine. I mean, it just didn't tell you what kind of game it was at all. And they said basically nothing about it.
I think that's the problem, though, with what John says. I think that's some of the issue, you know, with what happened with Rabbids Go Home, is a lot of people that might have enjoyed it were just completely switched off to its existence.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is with Rabbids now, I mean, I just instantly think, oh, another minigame collection. Like, it's become, you know, Ubisoft's Mario Party.
But on the other hand, it wasn't actually a minigame collection, so maybe it didn't appeal to that market either.
I just also think they're hideous little creatures. I just don't like them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not big on the characters themselves. I didn't find them really annoying. I mean, there's some bits that are kind of funny, like, obviously, like I said, you're going around scaring the clothes off everything. Mm-hmm. And you just see this guy who just happens to be standing next to an elevator. And, of course, your immediate reaction is to scare him. But when the elevator shaft's actually empty, he just goes, all the way down. So you've murdered that man.
Yeah, I've always felt like I didn't think the Rabbids were nearly as funny as Ubisoft does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the...
They're cute, I get it.
I think probably the best part of this is kind of the atmosphere. Like, they've got this brass band kind of soundtrack for the Rabbids, which is just perfect for the sort of hyperactive kind of buffoonery thing that they're doing. I mean, it's not the same as, like, the Blob, in the sense, like, with the Blob, the music is woven into the gameplay, and it's dynamic, and it's really vibrant, and, you know, it kind of builds in layers and stuff. It's not like that. I mean, actually, there's quite a lot of time where you either won't hear any music at all, or you'll actually hear like these 70s license tracks kind of as if they're over the PA. I'm guessing to reinforce the just awful hopelessness of this utilitarian nightmare future, whatever the hell it is. But yeah, so it's not a really big part of the game, but it is fun like that. That's probably the most appealing part of the game's personality for me, was the way they use music, actually.
All right, well, I guess we will move on, and I'll try to wrap up new business here. I have been playing some Red Steel 2, but I know James was playing it as well, so maybe I'll hold off on that till next week so we can talk about it together. But one thing that I bought this week on Amazon, and this is going to sound weird, but I got the Rock Band Portable Drum Kit from Mad Catz.
Now, explain what this is. I still don't understand exactly what it is.
It's not, John, honestly, I didn't even know what it was until I got it. So the reason I bought it is, number one, $10. It's down to $10. I don't know how long this thing's been out, but it is a big box full of hardware for $10. Like, it's a lot of stuff for very little money. But the main reason I bought it is that on NeoGAF, people were, I've been kind of interested in getting something for Xbox 360 with a decent D-pad on it. Because, you know, the standard controller has a shitty D-pad.
Extremely shitty.
Didn't they release a special pad in Europe or something, basically for football games, soccer games?
It's a, and it's a, like a limited edition, and they have never released it in America. So I could probably import one, but it,
probably more than $10,
right?
I'm guessing.
That's the thing. I mean, it's not like a pressing issue, but for $10, I would like to have a controller with a decent D-pad. Mm-hmm. And I know you're thinking, like, why would you want to use a drum kit as your controller?
Exactly.
So the portable drum kit, what it is like this rectangular brain. It's not really even a brain. It's more like a hub. And all of the drum pads hook into it. And this hub is a USB Xbox controller with a D-pad and four face buttons, and that's it. So it looks like an NES controller for your Xbox. And it's not really, it's not meant to be played as an NES controller for your Xbox. It's meant to be laid on the floor and you hook all these cords into it, right? But it totally works as an NES controller. And as it so happens, because it's a wired Xbox 360 controller, it also works with computers. So now I basically have an NES controller for my computer, and that can come in handy for various applications as well. So it seemed like a nice little thing to pick up for $10. Mm-hmm. Now, the really interesting thing is, I kind of thought that I would pull that out of the box and sort of throw everything else away because, you know, I don't travel with my Rock Band paraphernalia. Yeah. Like, I don't necessarily need a portable drum kit. So what this thing is, it's a series that it's five circular drum pads that are very flat and they're standalone. It's just the pad. It's basically like the very top layer of your Rock Band drum kit with a cord coming out of it. And you plug that cord into this thing that looks like an NES controller. And the idea is that these things are very lightweight. There's not a whole lot of structure to them. It's just a circle. And you can just kind of put this down anywhere on a table, on the floor, whatever, and hit it with your drumstick. So it makes sense if for some reason you really want to play Rock Band like on your family vacation. This allows you to sort of put an entire drum kit into a very small box and just kind of unpack it when you get there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I haven't actually used those drum pads yet, so I don't know how well they work, but I would assume that they probably work decently. I'm just not sure that I will ever have cause to really pull them out. But the other interesting thing is it comes with two very nice drumsticks. You know, Rock Band normally comes with wooden actual drumsticks, which... Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure they're really the best choice for the Rock Band drum controller, which is not a real drum kit. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it has a very different tactile feel, a very different response when you hit it. The drum heads on the controller, on the Rock Band controller, are really very different from the sort of stretched membrane that you get over a real drum. And so, you know, I'm not sure that wooden drumsticks are even the best choice. The ones that come with this Mad Catz thing are made of plastic, basically, and they come in two pieces and you screw them together and they have rubber tips, so they make a lot less noise when you hit anything with them. And so I actually gave these a shot and played on my normal Rock Band drum controller just using these drumsticks. I like them a
everything
lot better.
Everything but the actual drums.
Yeah. No, I like them. I like these drumsticks a lot better, and I didn't even know this kit came with drumsticks, so that was a nice surprise. It actually made me want to play Rock Band drums a little more, because usually I let other people do that. And finally, it comes with this kick pedal, you know, this portable kick pedal. It's a lot smaller than the official one. It's actually shaped more like a square or a sort of a stubby rectangle, and it's lower to the ground, so there's a much shorter lever arm on it. And again, I actually like this a lot better than the standard Rock Band drum controller. So I even plug this thing into my Rock Band drum kit, just replace the pedal. And it's a lot more comfortable. It makes your ankle less tired because you don't have to move it as much. And it's easier to move around because it's just much smaller, so you can kind of put it anywhere you want on the floor. So I bought this thing for basically an NES controller that's compatible with my Xbox and my computer. And it turns out there's actually some really nice drum kit stuff in here. So if you like Rock Band drums, you might actually want to think about this. And again, it's $10. So there's a lot of junk and not junk. I mean, there's actually a lot of decent hardware in there for $10. But anyway, that's just a weird hardware acquisition that I kind of wanted to throw out there.
All I can really say is that Microsoft should be ashamed that people that play their console have to go to those lengths to get a decent
right.
NES controller.
I'm buying a Mad Catz portable drum kit to get a Xbox controller with a decent D-pad.
That's just sad, man. That is sad.
Yeah, but this was a very popular solution on Gaff, and someone posted on there, hey, it's down to $10 on Amazon. And I'm like, okay, sold. I'll give it a shot. And I do like the little controller quite a bit. Last thing I'll mention this week is the Dragon Quest IX event that John talked about a little bit earlier. And I did actually go to one of these and actually met... There were about 6 or 7 people there playing Dragon Quest, in addition to the, you know, the regular customers who were kind of looking at us like we were crazy. Yeah. You know, I walked in there, I've got tag mode on, and everybody's like, oh, hey, you want to tag up? Okay, I'll put it on tag mode, because they were playing multiplayer. So they weren't in tag mode when I got there. So, but they were very, you know, they were very welcoming. They were like, oh, yeah, we'll go in there. They were a little disappointed that I didn't have a treasure map to offer them because I just wasn't that far in the game. Mm-hmm. But I got some of their treasure maps, and all of their characters are now hanging out in my inn, which is pretty neat. And you can, it turns out that when you sort of set up your game for tag mode in Dragon Quest IX, you can write a sort of a brief message, like 100 characters, or like kind of a Twitter length message that your character will say in the other person's game.
Oh, dear.
And so I basically used it to advertise Radio Free Nintendo.
Nice.
Is that now gonna propagate?
Well, I don't know that it. I don't think it propagates in a viral fashion. I think it shows up on the people I tag with, but then there's no way for it to then go transfer to right. people they tag with. So it can only go out to people that I actually come across. But anyway, it was a conversation starter. They saw that. They asked me about the show. So if any of you guys are listening, hello. Obviously the tag mode thing only takes a few seconds to do. And, you know, I pulled the one off of the Nintendo provided machine. So I got the official Nintendo map as well. And so now I have a few dudes hanging out in my inn. But after that, actually, you know, they were playing multiplayer, and I hadn't really planned to stick around and for very long and do that. But since, you know, we had started talking and everything, I figured I would try it. And so I booted up, and we played a multiplayer game. It's interesting the way it works, because I didn't have much experience playing, like, a local multiplayer RPG.
Yeah.
In America, that's not something we do. I guess if you're in Japan, that's Monster Hunter all over the place. But I don't have that experience. So... The way it works is that one person basically hosts, and you have to dismiss your party members so that those slots can be filled in by real players. So you have to not permanently dismiss them, but you kind of have to put them in the holding area for later. And you create empty slots in your party, and then you go to this desk at the end and say, you know, I want to open up my game to other people. And so then they can go look for games, and they find that, and then they come in. Now, the really interesting thing is that once they're in your game, you can all separate and go to completely different ends of the earth. So you can basically play the game totally separately. But the host player, which was in this case was me, has a function added to one of the menus that says Call to Arms. And when you use that, all the other players, no matter what they're doing, will be transported to your location. And you can even use this inside of a battle. So if I get in a battle and I'm in trouble, you know, because maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm the only one there and I'm fighting a group of enemies and it's too much. I can't handle it. I can use this Call to Arms, and they will be brought directly into my battle, which is a very elegant solution to the potential problems of people being able to do whatever they want in your game world. But they were excited because there's certain treasure chests that have basically randomly generated items, mostly like alchemy stuff, alchemy ingredients, that are sort of unique to your game, to your copy of the game, or they're randomly generated by some key or whatever. But, you know, even though we're playing through an area that they've already played through before, they're excited to run around and find the treasure chests.
Right.
And the cool thing is when they open those treasure chests, they get the item and then it closes and then all the other players can also get it. So it's not like they're competing for items necessarily. They're actually calling out to each other, oh, hey, I found one over here. You guys should come get it. So even though they're playing through an area with low-level enemies and they're doing a quest, they're helping me with a quest that they've already done, they still have an incentive to do it. You know, they're still excited about what can they find in this other player's world. Mm-hmm. And for me, there's a strong incentive because they're much higher level than me and they have a lot more skills. And so I was able to do a quest that would have been fairly difficult for me to do on my own. And instead, they're with me. And so we get up and do this quest and we fight up to the top of this tower and we battle a boss and they basically destroy him in two turns.
That's pretty cool.
I still get the experience from it. I get the quest completion. It allows me to now change jobs and everything. But they got something out of it as well. So it benefits everyone. It was a good time. And I'm pretty impressed by the implementation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to do more of that. So I recommend it to people. The Best Buy event will have already happened by the time this episode goes out. I'm going to try to get in on that. But I think it's even farther away, so I might have to drive like an hour to get to a Best Buy.
Yeah,
that's doing one of these events. So
yeah, that whole boss experience, Johnny, that is very MMORPG kind of online sort of thing, where you know you'll get a buddy, you'll have a friend who's already maxed out his character or whatever, and you're toiling away in the lower levels, but you'll run across something that you just can't beat. You know, you'll message him and say, hey, man, could you come over here for a second? He'll just come over, donk, like one hit the thing, and just you'll go about your business kind of thing. So,
right.
You know, it's always good to have friends, and that kind of, that's pretty cool. That kind of capitalizes on that.
Right. And what I like is that it incentivizes them to actually help me.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not depending on their good manners or their...
on them being your friends. Which in this case, they weren't.
Right. They're just people I'd never met before. One other thing I'll note about the little event is at the end, I was sort of interviewed about my experience by this very nice guy. He was dressed in a yellow shirt that said Famicom Dojo, which is I think a video series on YouTube that he's a fan of. And then he also had a yellow Wario hat, and he introduced himself to me as Jew Wario. he said he actually got the name from Game Jew, who's a guy that we've run into over the years at E3. And I guess Game Jew is now going by his real name, but he was inspired by him or something like that. So there's now like a YouTube video feature about this event, this Dragon Quest IX event, and you've got me on there. And the funny thing was, he asked, what I thought of the game and whether I had much experience with the series. And I said, well, yeah, I guess I've played Dragon Quest 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 8 and 9.
So, like every single one.
Yeah, but it might come across as snarky, but I actually didn't mean it that way. I just kind of started counting them up in my head, and I got about halfway through it. I'm like, oh my god, I can't believe I've played all these Dragon Quests, and they're all the same.
I mean, was that the launch event for Super Mario Galaxy in 2007? Basically, cause I was lazy, didn't pre-order the game. So I ended up queuing in quite cold conditions for ages, and I was in no mood to talk to anyone, and finally got in there about to get the copy signed by Charles Martinet and all that, and someone from some news outlet was kind of stopping people, and he stopped me and said, oh, have you got anything to say about the game? And I was like, no. So it was like, surely this is your favourite game? And I was like, I haven't even played it yet.
Yeah.
What's funny about that is that they're looking for some stupid, soundbite, like, oh my god, I'm the hugest fan, it's going to be the best game ever.
Somehow I doubt that you made it into the final edit, Greg.
You just refused to play the game.
I'm not your monkey.
the tragedy is I really am that enthusiastic about Super Mario Galaxy. It really is one of my favorite games of all time, but that was not the time to ask.
No.
When my hands didn't work properly anymore because they were kind of cold.
That reminds me, a few days ago, I got a text message from an old college friend, and he said, hey, is that Scott Pilgrim movie any good? And I said, I don't know, dude, it's not out yet. I appreciate that you value my opinion, but dude, try Google first. I mean, I have no idea. All right, well, that's the end of new business. When we come back, we'll have Neil on to talk about Mother 3.
Mother!
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right. Neil is here to help us out with now playing.
So we got a Tiger Woods PGA Tour 11, a belated review from both Zach and myself. You can find out what playing like Tiger on Wii is all about and how it's pretty much exactly like it is in real life, but you know, you're holding a Wii remote and a Motion Plus instead of an actual golf club.
Well, it's a very fun review, and I like the fact that you've got Neil, who reviewed last year's Tiger Woods, and Zach, who hasn't played one in 5 years.
And also, there's a ongoing developer diary that should be going on until mid-September on Flip's Twisted World. This week, we look at Flip's character design journey, and we look at how they began with The Apprentice and wound up with Flip. It's pretty interesting, and so is the other one from last week.
It is, yeah. I don't know how this game's going to turn out, but this is probably one of the most interesting developer diaries I've ever read on any website.
On the review side, we have Pop Island Paperfield, a DSiWare title, a review by Matt Blunden. Matt has a go with his Capture the Flag title and tells us why it's certainly worth its low 200 DSi point price tag. And Aaron also brings us impressions. He had some playtime with Metroid Other M just the other day. Gives us some updated impressions on what he thinks of the upcoming title. Find out what he thinks when he sees some newer sections that he hadn't come across before.
Yeah, this was an all-gameplay, no-story demo that Nintendo provided. And
they needed to do this.
Yeah, it was badly needed, and he saw a lot of stuff that no one has seen before, basically.
Yeah, possibly some spoilers, too, so...
Yeah, whatever.
Watch out. Be wary.
On the blog front, we have something from Neil here, as he opines on the fact that a cut-down version of NBA Jam is being given away on the HD consoles with NBA Elite Tour 11. Chime in and let us know how you feel about the latest broken promise of Wii exclusivity.
I don't really give a crap about this that much. I just thought it was interesting to note.
It is very interesting. You're just stirring the shit for the fans, you know.
Well, that's the thing. It actually, I read it, and it actually does have a pretty interesting comment thread going in there.
We also have a review of LEGO Harry Potter Years 1 through 4 from Andy for the Wii. He played through the puzzle-laden Harry Potter title and tells us whether or not it's worthy of the wizard. Glitches ahoy!
Oh,
yeah.
I think New Super Mario Bros. Wii has a competitor for worst game title on the system. So, wrapping up, we have a brand new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition featuring Michael TYP Cole and our Japanese correspondent, James Charlton, an old favorite from Radio Trivia. They bust out 5 new games, including, I'll tease you a little bit, Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door, which has some really interesting music from the GameCube title. So check out Radio Trivia if you like game music, or video games, or puppies, or world peace. All right, we are back for Retroactive.
Da, 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 da.
We've got Neil Ronahan with us.
Hello.
Special guest, Mother 3 expert. He's here to answer all of our questions. And James is here as well. Stinking of candles, I would assume.
Paraffin wax and fire.
Mm-hmm.
Candle wax on the nipples.
Isn't that much different than my regular day, no.
Greg has taken leave of us. He's going to bed early because he didn't get to play much Mother 3, and that's okay. He'll be back next week for the rest of the show. So Retroactive, this is where, if you're new to the show, Retroactive is where we let the listeners at home decide which game we're going to play out of a set of nominees. And then whatever wins the poll in the forums, we play that game and talk about it. This time we ended up, we had a set of Game Boy Advance games, and the winner was Mother 3, which is an anomaly for numerous reasons. Naturally, this game has not been released in the Western territories, so we are playing with a fan translation, and we'll talk maybe about the nature of that translation or the quality of it a little bit later. But the other thing is, this is the first really story-heavy game we've done in Retroactive, and we're struggling a little bit with how to handle that, because we had a group of people playing it in the forums who got really far very quickly, had a lot of things to say about sort of the late-game material, and I'm reticent to bring that stuff onto the show just because I know a lot of people at home are either playing along and maybe trying to catch up, or they've never played it. Maybe they're open to playing it, and maybe they'll decide to play it after they hear this discussion, but they don't exactly want the end of the game spoiled right off the bat. So I'm going to try to avoid that. We're going to talk about the story, and we'll maybe spoil some like very early stuff. So, you know, it's not going to ruin the rest of the game for you. But, you know, we're going to try to talk about the story here, but we're not going to get into the really late game stuff, at least right now. I might try to bring some of that stuff up in a couple of weeks, maybe during new business after I've beaten the game. And I'll mark that as spoiler territory before we get into it. I've played for almost 20 hours and I've still got quite a ways to go. I had the best intentions of beating the game before we got to this, and I tried, but I couldn't play enough of it with everything else going on. So, but Neil, you have beaten it, so you've got...
Yeah, it's been a while since I've beaten it. I think it was like a year and a half ago that I played through it. I was interested and I finally broke down and beat it. But I also have I think it was Fangamer had like a strategy guide slash like book thing that they sold around the time when I was playing it, and I ended up pre-ordering that and got that. So I skimmed through that to refresh my mind on the game. It's actually a really cool, like, I mean, it serves as a strategy guide, but it also kind of almost reads like a novel in some wow. parts, just because it kind of goes over the game.
That's really cool.
For anyone that's interested, I don't know if they're still selling it or not.
I have to look into that.
I actually remember that when they came out with that.
Right, I think it was like $20. I was playing through it when I heard about it, so I was like, well, fuck yeah.
It had some nice timing.
So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about some very basic stuff, some like really, really early stuff for Mother 3. I'm not sure that we ever really got into what the game is or maybe what it's about, and maybe at the time we didn't know what it was about. I feel like now I have a much better feel for that. So if anyone's coming into this fresh, Mother 3 is obviously the third game in this Mother franchise, which is primarily in Japan. The only game in the series that has come to the West is Mother 2, which we know as Earthbound. So Mother 3 is the sequel to Earthbound. And as Neil mentioned before we started recording, Mother 3 began as an N64 DD game. So this was supposed to be in 3D graphics back in the late 90s. And they, you know, the DD had all kinds of development problems.
It was moved off. It was going to be a retail N64 game with DD support, like bonus stuff. I think the bonus stuff was going to be basically dubbed Mother 3.5.
Wow.
And then, I think mid-2000, it was announced that it was finally canceled, and there was lots of sorrow amongst the dedicated Starman community.
Right.
We call them freaks, by the way.
Yes.
I respect those people. I don't know that I could ever love anything as much as they love Mother and Earthbound, but I respect them, and I think the Starman people have done a lot of good for publicizing this series, for spreading information about it, especially with Mother 3, as that was in development, and covering, you know, whether or not it would ever be localized, and helping to promote the fan translation, because otherwise I might not even know about that. I might not have played the game, so I do want to give them props. I've ragged on them a couple times before, but, you know, I respect those guys. It's a fan community for a very specific thing, but they do a good job, and their site is a nice archive of things, all things Mother. So, you know, in the early 2000s, it was announced that Mother 3 was being sort of revived as a Game Boy Advance title, and it finally came out in, what, 2006? 2005 or 2006?
I think it was early 2006.
Yeah, or pretty late GBA game.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was a really huge sales success in Japan at that point. They tried to prepare the market by releasing a GBA compilation of Mother 1 and Mother 2.
It was a compilation that they had the compilation on Game Boy Advance for Mother 1 and Mother 2, and it was because of the mild success of that they even did Mother 3.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't know it had that much influence on it. I thought it was just kind of a side thing. Yeah, unfortunately, Mother 1 and 2 compilation has not come to America either. You know, half of that game is Earthbound, which we do have, but the original Mother 1's never been released over here either. That was for Famicom, so that's an older game.
But that's the one where there's an official translation of it or something?
Yes, that's the whole Earthbound Zero thing. We don't have time to get into the the mythology around that, but it's a pretty interesting story. You can look it up online, Earthbound Zero, if you're curious to find out more about what all happened with that. But yeah, that's another game that I could play. I've never gotten around to it. I've heard that it's just not designed as well as the second and third games, and so it's a little bit harder to get into. But, you know, Mother 3 is a Japanese RPG. It's set in sort of a contemporary world, so it's not Dungeons & Dragons, it's not sci-fi stuff, it's sort of modern day, kind of. But there's a lot of weird elements. There's dinosaurs and weird animal combination things like mutants and a lot of strange stuff going on, a little bit like Dragon Ball Z, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago. So, you know, it plays very much like a Final Fantasy or an old Dragon Quest game or a new Dragon Quest game. But the story is presented in a very different way, I think. And there are some differences as well. I mean, there's no random battles, so you can always see enemies. You can try to avoid them. A lot of this stuff is out of Earthbound, so it's quite similar to Earthbound, but just more refined in certain ways. And, you know, it's a GBA RPG, so if you've played any other ones like that, I think you'll kind of know what you're getting into with this. So let's talk a little bit about the overall structure of the game. It's divided into chapters, and up through the first three chapters, you're playing as different characters that are not the main character of the story, who's Lucas.
Yeah.
So, James, is it jarring for you to get to the end of a chapter and now be thrown into a totally different character with different abilities and, you know, your level ups don't really transfer?
I'm not sure jarring is the word I would look for.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like they just had this concept of let's make a bunch of different games in a way, if that makes sense, but within the same structure of the game itself.
So, well, it does kind of provide a kind of variety that you don't often get in RPGs, right?
Yeah.
Because the characters play very differently from each other.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it, to be honest.
Do you think it prevents you getting attached to any one of the characters? In other words, does it kind of work against itself?
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I didn't particularly feel attached to any of these characters because they're just so damn weird.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much, there's not a normal person in this game.
Yeah, that's very true.
I mean, the guy that marks your map might be the most normal person in town.
And his name is Mapson.
Mapson!
His name is Mapson. He's our baseline, and all he does is circle places on a piece of paper, and that's his career path.
Well, what about the tall guy who rings the bell?
I love that guy.
Well, he's also the size of a six-story building, so we're pretty much going to preclude him from discussions of normalcy.
Right.
And he just stands there.
He doesn't really talk. Yeah.
He's just there. That's his job is to not move.
So I know one of the criticisms of the chapter structure and frequently changing lead characters here is that it slows down the pace of the game. And I felt that way about Dragon Quest IV, because it feels like, you know, you get a character going and you start, you know, you get some level ups and you buy some new equipment and you feel like, okay, I'm building up some momentum here, and then it goes and it yanks out that character and it gives you a new one that's now like back to level one or whatever, and it just feels like you're constantly being pushed back to an earlier point in the way the characters develop.
See, I'm used to having games where the characters get reset or you have to kind of rebuild the character, because I've played a lot of strategy RPGs where that concept really has root, because a lot of times you'll get new characters and they come in starting as just useless wastes of humanity.
Yeah.
But you have to make them practical, because otherwise when you need them they're cannon fodder.
Well, it's not quite the same here, because it's not like you have an army and you're
I know, but the concept of once you finally feel like, okay, I've got everybody I want going, and then somebody else shows up and you're, damn it, I have to get this guy moved now.
Yeah,
it sort of reminded me of Final Fantasy III on the Super NES, where the characters are constantly kind of rotating in and out.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do feel like it slowed the pace of the game down, which in many ways was already pretty slow.
Mother 3, it does start out really slow. That first chapter took me a long time to get through.
Well, I mean, it's not just how long it takes to move the story along, which, especially in the first chapter, takes a while.
It does, yeah.
But everything about the game is kind of slow. I mean, you don't move particularly fast, unless you're playing the game at 3x turbo. But even then, you're not moving that fast.
Yeah.
The battles themselves, even though they don't stop to generate, like, watch your health go down, they still feel very slow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, even starting a battle, burp, and then there's that pause where you can kind of turn around for a second, and then it goes, burp, and it starts the battle.
Yeah.
I mean, even, there's just a lot of things about this game that make it feel slow, and that kind of factors into it, these character restarts.
Definitely the pace of the game, especially in those first three chapters when you're jumping from character to character, is really slow, and I'll admit to when I first played this game, a friend of mine was playing it at the same time, and we both got to around chapter 3 and then put it down for a couple days. And then I was like, I guess we'll still play this, even though, I mean, we enjoyed it, but it was just going too slow. And I think that once you actually get your regular team, and when you start with, you know, when you finally play as Lucas, the main character in chapter 4, I think that the pace, I mean, it's still lots of game after that, but the pace picks up a lot, I feel.
Yeah, and you can argue that the game really starts in chapter 4, because that's when you finally control Lucas, who's the hero. And that's when they introduce money to the game. Like, that's a weird thing, you know, when you start out, you're in this Tasmili village, and...
Communists. They're communists.
Well, I mean, that's part of the overarching story, too, is the introduction to money to this small town that originally operated, you know, as communists.
It is really interesting. Yeah, in Chapter 3, you have this kind of nasty guy named Facade, and he wants to do something bad to the village where Lucas lives. And he comes in...
Predatory lending.
He gives this... something like that. He's basically selling them something called a happy box. Or he's giving it away. But the happy box...
John regularly consults this happy box.
The happy box, it seems to kind of taint the souls of the people in the town. He's making it into a real city, you know. He's bringing civilization to this village, this kind of podunk village.
Oh, so he's white man. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. but it seems to come at some price, and it's not really clear what the price is. But when you enter Chapter 4, and it's 3 years later, and the town has been sort of transformed by this all this new technology and progress, you know, there's a lot of new stuff there. There's a lot of new stuff to do. All the characters are still there, but it seems like something bad has happened. And what's really interesting to me is that the game is clearly intentionally ambiguous about what exactly has gone on here, because you go into all the houses have happy boxes in them, and the happy boxes looks, maybe it's a computer, maybe it's a TV. It's not real clear. It's glowing. It doesn't have any message for you. It doesn't seem to do anything. It just sits there. And everybody has one. And everybody also has these nice houses. They make money. They work in the factory. They have a train. You know, it's very interesting commentary.
Consumerism.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's just weird because... It's weird because clearly money has come into this town and has changed this town, and it's brought a lot of what we would consider to be nice things.
The trappings.
It's not like the town is a total shithole when you get back to it. I mean, it looks like a city. It looks like what you would expect a city to look like, you know? It's not necessarily a bad thing, and yet as you're walking around, you get the feeling that Lucas is out of place. And you get the feeling that some kind of innocence has been lost that was there before. And the weird thing is that the game doesn't really beat you over the head with that. You know, it doesn't come
subtle.
Out and tell you, here's the theme of the game. It just operates on a different level. I was very impressed with that.
It's also interesting how, like, the transfer to the, you know, the bigger town or city in Chapter 4 is also kind of like how, when you go into Earthbound, the hook with that is that it was like, a town that you would go to, you know, there were cities that, okay, everything was still kind of weird, but, you know, you went to an ATM to get money, you know, called your dad to save your game.
Right.
And it's almost like the Tasmili Village in the beginning of the game is something that's weirder and might be out of a typical RPG, whereas when you get to the city, I mean, it's still weird in that mother style, but it's more akin to what you might find in Earthbound.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like a commentary on itself.
Yeah.
Well, there is a lot to comment on in Earthbound. So a commentary on itself would probably not be all that charming, to say the least.
and, of course, that's the point where you get money, so now you can actually buy better equipment. And, again, it's weird. It almost feels like introducing money into this world is like polluting it somehow, and yet you need it. You know, you can't really play the game without money. And the way money works is similar to Earthbound, where you fight monsters and... you accumulate money when you beat monsters, but it doesn't even tell you how much.
You have to go to Frogs.
That's right. You have to go to the Frog ATM to get your money out. And some people in the forums apparently didn't realize that you got money at all from monsters. They didn't. They never went to that option in the frog menu. And so they played the entire game without ever getting any money from battles to buy things with, which I can, they must have had to grind so much to make up for the deficit in equipment. I just can't imagine.
They are true comrades.
Yes.
They make the commissar proud.
Pro tip, withdraw your money from the frog to buy things.
The frog is the key.
Yeah. So, boy, what do we want to talk about next?
Talk about the battle system?
Yeah, the battle system. James is right that...
Welcome to the NES. That battle system literally is like Final Fantasy 1 battle
system. In Mother
system.
3, they actually add a lot of different wrinkles to it. They make it like it's an RPG where there's that rhythm to it and the way that, you know, there's that backbeat that if you get...
I guess, but it's
I forget the name of the item that you get, but it adds that layer to it.
It's Duster's Hypno Pendulum.
Yes.
I haven't actually been using that. I need to learn how to do that. I've been reading people post about it, but I haven't actually taken the time to go try to figure it out.
I mean, it's tough to grasp, but once you do, you know, you can do quite a bit of damage that way, and it's definitely an interesting wrinkle on what was in Earthbound, a very, very primitive battle system.
It really was.
It's still very primitive, but they're adding, you know, these different kind of wrinkles that you don't really see too much.
Earthbound's battle system is literally... like Final Fantasy 1.
It's Dragon Quest.
Dragon Quest 2 is what it is.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy 1 is a little bit different. But, you know, I like the battle system. It's certainly simple. It's not
serviceable.
Mega complex, I mean, or sophisticated
serviceable.
Or anything.
It's serviceable. I mean, it drove me nuts how, you know, when one of your characters gets hit, you have to sit there and watch the number spin down. It drove me nuts.
Well, I mean, that also helps out in later parts where if you receive mortal damage, if you can, you know, use, you know, a healing item before it ticks down, that person won't die.
Okay.
And it also helps where, like, I think there's one point where there's, you know, like a bomb will go off and it'll do damage, but if you can attack the other enemy before you die, then you can get out of the battle fine.
Okay. It adds a timing element to the battle.
Yes.
In that if something really bad happens and a character is going to die, you have a finite amount of time to do something about it to save them.
See, that's the exact thing. I mean, right there.
And the penalty for dying is pretty high because it's hard to revive people once they die.
Yeah.
So it actually motivates you to, oh my God, someone took mortal damage. Well, I better run away or end this battle or heal them as fast as possible.
Yeah.
It doesn't, John, I mean, where you are early in the game, it's not much of a factor because you only have one or two people in the party and your life points, you know, are so small that you don't really have enough time to react to it. But as your maximum hit points get higher and higher and higher, it gives you more of a buffer to actually do something about it. And it becomes an important part of the game later on. It's actually quite interesting.
Now, is it really explained though? Because I don't remember that being explained at any point.
I'm trying to think.
There's probably some character somewhere who says something.
From a sparrow, like a random sparrow.
Yeah.
It's just a bird.
Yeah. It is something that you would learn through experience over time, I think. You would kind of observe that, oh, if the battle ends, you know, this person took mortal damage, but then the battle ended and they stayed alive because their hit points weren't done counting down.
Yeah, you'd have that eureka moment.
It's really done exactly the same as in Earthbound, but it is something that no other RPG really does. No other RPG series.
Yeah, anymore. I mean that's what I was saying before, is that it's a very primitive battle system, but they add these wrinkles to it that I think are pretty cool, and they make it, you know, different than any other RPG out there.
Right. I really like the kind of overworld exploration stuff. And the game is fairly linear. There aren't that many places where, for instance, there's no point where you're going to get out in the world and not really be sure of where to go next.
Well, no, because it's marked on your map.
Right, and there's not really...
Thank you, Mapson.
There's not really any point where you're moving from town to town. There's not much stuff like that. Generally, the game gives you, like, one area at a time to operate within, and then when you beat the chapter, it'll take you to a completely different area.
Yep.
And maybe they connect later on, but... you know, generally you're kind of working within a finite area, which is I think it makes it a little bit easier to find your way around. But, you know, there's still little things hidden around. There's gift boxes all over the place. And one thing I really, really like is the way that you learn new magic spells. Or psi powers is what they're called. But when you have gained enough levels for Kumatora or Lucas to learn a new spell, what'll happen is you don't learn it at the end of battle when you get the level up. What happens is sometime after that, as you're walking around, it'll say, Lucas started to feel feverish.
Yeah.
And you see, and you slow down a little bit, and you see like sweat coming off of his head, and you walk around for another minute or two, and eventually it'll say, Lucas's fever went away, but he learned a new psychic power. And that's how you learn new spells. So you actually, there's this period where you might actually want to avoid battles during this time so that you can learn the spell and then take that into the next battle. I mean, I don't know how much it adds to the game mechanically, but stylistically, I love the idea that basically, like, your character's, like, freaking out. Like, oh, I don't feel so good. But in the process, it's because their body is, like, undergoing some kind of transformation, and they come out of it more powerful than before.
That's what I like. I mean, the game seems to go out of its way to not be the same old mechanical JRPG.
Yes.
Right.
Like, it surprises you. It does weird things, but then it almost challenges the player to make sense of what it's giving them. Whereas most JRPGs, they just, you know, spoon feed you exactly what's going on.
Everything's so literal. Yeah. I mean, I do think Mother 3 is a game where a lot of things are left up to the player to interpret the way you want it to. It seems that way so far. Maybe everything is explained point by point in the ending. But, you know, I feel like a lot of this is, you know, they kind of throw things at you and they make you, you know, it makes you wonder, well, why are these people dressed like pigs? Is there a reason for that? Maybe there is, or maybe there isn't.
The pig mask army.
Maybe it's just nonsense, but I mean, the thing is, there are enough serious elements to the themes of the story that it makes you take a second look at some of the really silly things and think, well, is there a reason that it's that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe there is. I mean, I hope that in the end, some of these things are left open and it's ultimately up to the player to decide how much you want to look into it. But I, you know, even as you're playing through, it's quite intriguing because, yeah, I mean, a typical Japanese RPG, everything is like really straightforward and there's not a whole lot of room for interpretation. In mm-hmm. Mother 3, there definitely is. It's more like a novel, which, you know, it's written by a Japanese novelist.
Yeah, I mean, it creates stuff like, you know, subtexts where most JRPGs are just like, yep, here you go. The story doesn't really get any deeper and you can't really interpret anything.
Right.
Like, there's just a lot of weird elements of this, and especially as you get near the end of the game, even weirder stuff comes about, too.
Well, it's funny because I think it probably does a better job of it through more primitive means than other games that really are trying to be kind of artsy, you know? Mm-hmm. Like any of Hideo
Absolutely.
Kojima's messes.
Yeah,
example.
Or even Final Fantasy 13, which has a pretty cool story, but there's not much left to the imagination about what that game is about. You know, it's not even that complicated of a story arc, really.
Yeah.
And the characters are constantly talking to each other about their feelings and what all of this means and why they're doing what they're doing. You know, and Mother 3, it just leaves it up to you to kind of interpret it the way you want to. And I do like that a lot. One thing that we were talking about before the show is the, and this is a very early game spoiler, but there's a scene where the two boys, Lucas and Klaus, their mother is killed in chapter one. And the way that whole thing is handled, I know that you guys have some feelings about that. So James, why don't you start with your kind of take on that whole thing?
I thought it was handled by like the world's worst writer. because can I just go ahead and say how it's handled?
Yeah, sure.
You are playing as the father of the two boys, and he's been looking for his boys after he rescued someone else's child from a fire in the
right.
woods. And then they realize, hey, you know, your kids are supposed to come back today. Where were they at? Oh, I don't know. So everybody in town goes out and looks for them in the woods. He accomplishes a whole shitload of nothing looking for them.
Yeah.
And then somebody runs and gets him saying they found the kids. So he goes over there, and they're all gathered around a fire. And then another character comes. They haven't found their mother yet. So another character shows up, pulls them aside, and says, I've got good news and bad news. Which one do you want to hear? then they don't let you pick. He just decides, no, I'll tell you the good news first. And it was that he found this dragon's tooth, which will make you an awesome sword.
Yes.
And now the bad news is, I found it in your wife's heart. And
yeah.
It's like, wow. Thank you, game. That was handled terribly.
Nah, see, that's the thing, though. But to
I kind of like it.
I disagree so hardcore.
I totally disagree because I was like, okay, whatever. They're just gonna hand you a quest and be like, go off and find your wife, and you know, you just go
right.
traipsing off, right? No, I was just like, what? You gotta be kidding me. What the hell?
I was like, holy shit, that is hardcore. I found this thing in your wife's heart.
I figured she had to be dead because they pulled you aside from the kids. Basically, I have good news and bad news.
Yeah, but I didn't think he was going to put it
that
way.
The bad news is she's dead. Yeah. The good news is you found a fucking sword. Fuck you. And then
I love the way that's handled because it's a very video game way of handling, or at least saying, oh look, I found this tooth that can make an awesome sword. It's just something that you'd see in a video game, you'd see in an RPG where you pick up this item and then you can make it into a weapon. And then they just totally blindside you by having the fact that your wife is dead. I found this in her heart, and
it's such a stark shift in tone.
It comes out of left field, and I think it's great how they toy with the conventions.
What amazed me about it, right, is you have to realize that true deaths of characters in games are so rare.
Right.
Like really impactful deaths where it's like the person died, people feel bad, and you can't bring that person back. There's no magic, there's no resurrection or nothing like that.
And this woman is not necessarily someone who you've got a strong attachment to at that point in the game.
Yeah.
Because you've seen her for all of maybe 3 minutes total.
But the aftermath of the effect that it has on her family is handled really interestingly, I think. I mean, that funeral scene is morose. Like really morose in a game full of dragons and lions with mechanical octopus tentacles coming out of them. I mean that funeral scene is like, wow, this is truly sad.
But see, that's why it just doesn't feel like that her actual death was handled right, because they basically said, all right, we're going to make this a really impactful death, but then we're going to make how she died practically high comedy.
That is so mother though. I mean, to handle something serious in a silly way. Or vice versa.
That's the tone of the game, though, and it does a great way of setting that tone of how, like, yeah, this is going to be really goofy, but occasionally some really serious shit's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we call that somebody with manic depression. I mean, this game has a psychological disorder.
Okay.
So you're saying Mother 3 is manic depressive. That's pretty interesting to me. I mean, yeah. I don't know if I agree with you or not, James, but I think that says a lot right there that you would even suggest that.
I think what's worse about that particular scene, though, is that afterwards, like, oh yeah, you can go pick up this tooth after I'll make a sword out of my house. Do you really think he wants it? It's a video game.
That's the whole point of it. That's a very video game thing that's happening in a serious situation.
Yeah, but see, the interesting thing is, right, what I thought was brilliant that they did with that whole death was the fact that if you went around and talk to all the characters, they're just like, there's no like, hey, you know, go out there and you fight the good fight. They're all just like, yeah, man, I really don't know what to tell you, you know. I mean, those characters react realistically to that death, where they're like, hey, you know, hey, hang in there, you know, I know I don't know how you're feeling, and I can't pretend to explain.
I don't know what to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a lot of that, and that really impressed me, because deaths in video games are so trivialized. They're like, oh, that person was great, but we'll go out there and we'll beat the bad guy in the end, and then you just, you know, carry on with the story. Like, there's really no impact.
And, you know, that's the point where I appreciated that the game had me playing this first chapter as the father.
Yeah.
Because if Lucas is the main character of the story, you need to see how this event will shape Lucas and his actions, how it will motivate him later on. But if you're playing as Lucas in that chapter, they can't really show that to you because you're in control and you find out your mom's dead and then you have to go equip a new sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really inappropriate. But because it's told through this other character, even the father, that even adds another layer to it. But the fact that it's told that you're playing as any other character than Lucas means that you can actually observe what Lucas does and how he handles it. And also Klaus, how he handles it. And they take very different paths from that point on because they react to it very differently. And I think the fact that you've seen this game and it's so silly and all this stuff is happening, it's like, well, okay, the forest is on fire, that sucks, but you know, it's being caused by alien dudes and pig masks. It all seems so silly, and all of a sudden it drops this like really serious event on you.
Yeah.
And that's like, wow, I'm gonna have to really brace myself for the rest of this game.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, just when I think it's becoming really whimsical and, you know, everything's just totally crazy and hunky-dory, something else really bad could happen, because I know it already has. And so it shakes you. right? I mean, it makes you feel more insecure about playing the game because you can't just take it lightly from that point on.
Yeah. I mean, it's you can even relate this to movies, too, and how, like, when you kill off a main character in a movie early on or halfway through, it gives you that sense of discomfort and uneasiness throughout the rest of it because you know that, hey, all bets are off. Someone else could die, too. And even if nothing else bad happens, you know, you still have that sense of discomfort that, you know, something bad could happen.
It tells you that no matter what, this story is going to end up with consequences for the characters.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's also a sense of loss, too, because I was kind of looking forward to, you know, the mother character is kind of in the background, and it's almost, I was kind of looking forward to meeting back up with her and her being brought back into the storyline and maybe getting to know that character. But it's weird because they deny the player that. And as a player, you're not used to being denied things. You know, you're used to being given everything. Like, oh, here's a character, play with it. Here's a part of the story, go read it or go play through it.
And the fact that her funeral takes place in the cemetery and then on your way out, there's a sign outside the cemetery that says no zombies allowed.
Yeah.
And I seriously thought for a second, oh my God, they're going to bring her back as a zombie. That would be so inappropriate. And luckily, as far as I've seen, that doesn't happen. But the game is so fucking crazy that you actually consider that possibility for a moment.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, I hope that doesn't happen. Because I want her to stay dead. Like, to me, that is a very important part of the story. And, it made me respect the game right up front. In a way that I wouldn't normally with other games. You're not going to see that in Dragon Quest, really.
No.
I mean, and even in Dragon Quest 9, and in Dragon Quest 5 as well, there are characters who die, but you don't have any kind of relationship with them before, and it ends up not really feeling all that consequential later on.
Yeah.
And in Dragon Quest 5, all the characters who die come back as ghosts, and the same thing in 9, you can see ghosts, so even when someone dies, it's like, oh, now I can get a quest from them.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely in Dragon Quest IX, going through a couple of those towns, like, some sad stuff happens, but it's still, I mean, it's Dragon Quest IX, it's still kind of goofy throughout it all, because the people are named weird, you're in this weirdly named town, and there's cruel cumbers.
Well, Mother 3 is much sillier than Dragon Quest IX, but at the same time, it's also a lot more serious than Dragon Quest IX.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me that it can pull off both of those, and, you know, I can see how when they come up that close together, as in that conversation that James described, I can see how that might rub people the wrong way. And clearly James is not all that enamored with the dichotomy here.
Well, I think it didn't need to do that to have the effect, because it really kind of cheapened the funeral scene afterwards. Because it's like, okay, all these characters really don't know how to handle this, except for this jackass who thinks I want to know about a sword that could be made out of the thing that killed her.
I feel like the game succeeded with you, even though you fucking hate it.
It basically means, like, that guy right there, I should go kill him with the thing that he wants to be made, because he doesn't belong in this town.
Yeah.
He's an asshole. And then everybody flips out when you go crazy afterwards. It's like, no, this guy's a jackass. He deserves to be hit with a flaming board. And he might be the worst. He's the villain of this game. He really is.
Like I said, James, even though you despise this part, I feel like the game worked with you.
No, it didn't. It actually did. Took me out of the game. It made me feel like,
you
wow.
You are so pissed off about this scene.
The more you protest, the more it shows you love this game.
No, it proved to me that Ito is a terrible writer and why his novel didn't sell.
No, because he's good at writing game scenarios, not novels.
So maybe this is a way to segue into a different aspect of the game, which is the writing and the localization in particular. Obviously, we don't know that much about the original text because it's in Japanese, so we're not really clear on how accurate this translation is. What I will say is that it does seem very much in line with the Earthbound translation that Nintendo did do, and there's also that official translation of Mother 1, Earthbound 0, that's floating out on the internet somewhere. So the guys who localize this, they have a pretty good basis to go on of how this series has been handled in the past in America. And so I definitely feel like if you had told me, you know, if I didn't know anything else about Mother 3 and you had told me, hey, here's this Game Boy Advance game, you know, from Nintendo, I would have thought Nintendo had written this for the most part. There's one or two very small things that I think probably would have been censored down a level by Nintendo of America. But for the most part, I think they nailed the style of, at least they nailed the style of Earthbound, which is what I have to compare it to. But I've been very impressed with the localization. Just it feels natural. It feels professional.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to translate here. You know, a lot of the characters will say multiple things if you talk to them multiple times.
Yep.
And the characters, you know, as in with a lot of Nintendo RPGs, the characters, even like the most minor character in the game, it kind of has its own personality that's unique to just that one little character that you might not ever even talk to.
Yeah.
And that's hard to pull off. I mean, that really takes a lot of creativity and a lot of, I would assume, localization management to make that work, to actually pull, you know, have different personalities for all the different characters.
Well, it depends on how literally you translate the game, too. I mean,
well, even if you assume that it's not a literal translation at all, you still have to write different personalities for 100 characters. That's a big job.
Yeah.
I mean, that's difficult to do. So I respect it very much for that. And it goes back to one of the popular things about the game that people in the forums mention is that every single character sprite in the entire game is unique.
Yeah.
There's no stock dude, you know, that they give different names or that just repeats in every town. Every single character in the game has unique art. And to go with that, they seem to have a unique personality as well. And that's really impressive. And it must have made this a ton of work to localize. Really a ton of work.
I'm glad they did it.
Yeah,
or else I would have never been able to play this game, because I sure as hell wasn't going to learn Japanese to play this.
Yeah.
Well, so that then begs the question, you know, how do you think Nintendo might have localized it differently? Are you surprised that they chose not to bring this to America?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I have no idea why they didn't.
I do.
I mean,
came out late in the GBA's life, and they wanted the GBA to die.
So, James, you don't think it's anything specific to this game?
Well, I think that they probably didn't feel like the market was substantial enough to necessitate the job. And they weren't particularly, you know, in the mood of supporting the GBA at that point either. I mean, not only was the GBA dead in their eyes, but it wouldn't actually die. It was because if remember, they basically kept trying to kill the GBA. Like, all right, there will be no more games for it. And then it would keep selling. And they'd be like, all right, why? Buy DSs, please.
So, James, you don't think it's because of, you know, the content of the game being controversial?
No, I think it was a purely economic decision. They didn't feel like it would make the sales they needed justify the expense. And it was on a system they weren't really eager to support anymore.
Yeah. I agree with you there. John, what were your thoughts on the localization in general?
Well, I mean, I can see that. I mean, it did come out kind of at an odd time, but it just amazes me that a game, like, I just think that Nintendo has brought over many more games that were much shittier than this.
Yeah, but what's the expense of
it? It would have been a pain in the ass to localize this as far as effort. I mean, like Johnny said, there's a lot of text to localize in this.
They localized Disaster, but it was already in English.
Yeah.
So it wasn't exactly a huge deal.
That's the thing. I mean, like, from a business standpoint, probably not the best candidate for bringing over here, but from a gamer standpoint, I'm like, come on. It's such a quality game.
Yeah. Maybe a good way to wrap it up, Neil, since you've actually played the entire game, maybe you could tell us something that happens later in the game, or maybe just kind of give a general sense of your kind of overall view of it that would maybe give us some encouragement to keep playing it after this feature's over, and maybe we'll help encourage some of the people listening at home to give the game a shot.
The last area of the game is pretty good, especially if you enjoyed Earthbound. It's very interesting in that regard, and it does, I mean, it shows that this game is a sequel to Earthbound in some kind of peculiar way. I mean, I was actually mentioned to the friend of mine that also played it alongside me that I was going to be coming on and recording this, and we were talking about it for a little bit, and we actually compared and how this relates to Earthbound is kind of like how Chrono Cross relates to Chrono Trigger, except for it's a lot clearer in this.
It couldn't be less clear.
Yeah.
Chrono Cross and Chrono Trigger are very explicitly related. I mean, there's a whole section of the game about it.
Yeah, keep on drinking the Kool-Aid, James.
There is a whole section. The characters from one game are in the other. The relation is explained.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Mother 3, I mean, it does relate to Earthbound in a way that's kind of neat, and it will explain parts of Super Smash Bros. Brawl, too. Like,
wow.
New Pork City.
How's that for a tease? Yeah, I haven't seen New Pork City, and I've been playing for almost 20 hours.
Yeah, I think my memory serves me correctly, you should be pretty close to getting there.
Okay.
But basically, New Pork City is where a lot of the interesting, you know, Earthbound references happen, and really the game gets explained, so to speak. And
interesting.
You might not like the ending, but it's definitely, if you've invested time in it, or if you're interested to see what happens, it's totally worth going through it. I mean, especially looking at what people are saying in the forums, the ending seems to be pretty divisive. Mm-hmm. And that some people like it a lot and other people don't really seem to like it, but the bottom line is that everyone seemed to enjoy the game. And yeah. I think that's the important part. It's kind of like how, you know, endings to movies and books might not like it, but you still enjoyed it.
Right. I mean, the ending is a small part of the experience. Yeah. So even if you don't like it. For my part, I would say, having played through about 3/4 of the game probably.
Yeah, I'd say that.
What I would say is to anyone who's just starting it or is a little worried about what we talked about with the pacing, you know, the slowness of it in the beginning, is that the game gets better and better and better as you go.
Yep.
And especially once you hit chapter 4, it feels like it really picks up steam there and you get a lot more persistence in your character development, and it gets really exciting because when I learn a new psi power with Lucas, I know he's going to keep it. I know I'm going to have that, you know, so I don't have to worry about it about losing it when I get to the end of the chapter. And I just feel like the pace of the game, like you start to see new areas, you stop revisiting the same places you've been to before, and you actually start going to new places and doing new things and meeting new people, and it really picks up a lot. So that's why I'm definitely going to keep playing it and looking forward to seeing the whole end of it.
And there's a section where the dog walks on two legs because he has to wear a disguise, which is really funny.
Yes, that is pretty funny.
Awesome.
And everybody says, "You smell like a dog." and there's a character named Neckbeard.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I forgot about that.
If that's not incentive to play, I don't know what isn't. John, final question. Which game do you think you'll finish first? Mother 3, Chrono Trigger, or Final Fantasy 13?
None of the above.
Oh, it's a tough one. My guess would be Mother 3. That would be my guess.
Well, we shall see. We shall see. Place your bets now.
Well, I think Chrono Trigger already lost.
I'm taking the over-under on his life because that's coming to an end before these do.
One final note. Of course, thank you very much to Neil for helping us out with this.
Anytime.
And I want to thank the people in the forums who are playing along. They left a lot of really in-depth, what I am sure are very fascinating comments that I haven't read because they're spoiler tagged out to all hell. And a lot of them say, at the end of chapter 7, blank, 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 blank. And it's like, I'm not going to read that because I'm not to that point yet. But I do very much appreciate it. And I hope the people in the forums have gotten something out of playing the game together as a group. And certainly, you know, that forum thread will keep on going for perpetuity. And as I continue to play through the game, and I hope as others do as well, they will jump in there. And once they catch up to that point, read that stuff, comment back on it, and keep the discussion going. And I'm looking forward into jumping into that aspect of the conversation. And that ended up making up kind of the bulk of that forum thread was, you know, kind of people talking about what happens at the end. Apparently, there's a lot to say about it because there's some long forum posts about that stuff. And so I'm very curious to kind of catch up and then go check that out. And I hope everybody listening will as well if you decide to get into Mother 3. So with that, we are going to end this segment and the episode. Thanks to everybody listening, and thanks to John, James, and Neil for accompanying me on this psychedelic journey through Mother 3.
Aww.
And through RFN 205. We will have listener mail coming back next week, so please send your letters into rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And don't worry if you sent one in and you haven't heard it yet. We've got some catching up to do, and we will be going through the backlog to find the good shit. One last thing. I am proud to announce, and I don't know why it took us so long, but Radio Free Nintendo is now on Facebook. So we have like a fan page. You can go on there and meet us and meet the other fans and interact and get the latest updates, which will also be cloned onto the NWR Twitter account, I think. Man, we're getting so modern. But anyway, go to Facebook and search for Radio Free Nintendo. You should see it. Alternatively, you can go to NintendoWorldReport.com and visit the RFN main
podcast page, and you should see one of those little boxes embedded there, and you can do it from there, so you don't even have to go to Facebook. So yeah, check that stuff out, join the community, and we'll see how many fans we can get up to. All right, we'll be back next week, and until then, peace.
Bye.
Later.
No, they were asking me about it, and they were not familiar with the podcast, but they seemed interested when I told them about it, so maybe they're listening now. And, I told them that I write for Nintendo World Report, and again, you get kind of these blank faces, and I said, any of you ever heard of Planet GameCube? And everybody's like, oh, yeah, okay, I used to run that. Wow.
One day we will escape its shadow, Johnny. One day.
I don't know how much longer it's going to take. It's been 4 years.
Shit. But, we're just going to call the site Planet GameCube again next time we do a redesign. We're just going to go back to it.
Oh, it's at least it's better than sometimes I get these emails from family members or old friends, and they say, hey, what game should I get for the Wii? It's like, I understand why they think I'm a good person to ask, and I am a good person to ask, but that question is so open-ended. Like, the problem is I know too much about games on the Wii to answer that question succinctly. So it's like a paralyzing question. It's like, dude, I don't know. What do you like?
Yeah.
I just come across as being not very helpful when I should be the most helpful person they could possibly ask.
Well, the thing is, you know so much that you can't just give a pat answer, right?
Like, what I want to say is, go to the damn website.
Yeah.
What's a good CD to get for my Discman, Johnny?
Oh man, Dark Side of the Moon. I don't know.
See, he's more specific.
This is the first thing that came to mind.
The frog is the key.
Yeah, it's true. It's not explained very explicitly, but you know, they do mention that DP is money, and I think that's pretty obvious from the interface. So
yeah,
when the frog says DP stuff, you might want to go check that out.
Well, DP. You say it like that.
And cut.